Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
We consider dogs some of our best friends and most beloved family members. But as dog cognition scientist Alexandra Horowitz explains in her latest book, Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond, the dog-human relationship is more complex than we might think. Horowitz is head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University, and I'll be talking with her tomorrow at the Boston Book Festival in Copley Square. WBUR is a presenting partner there. But first, we invited her here into Studio 3 to talk about her book. She joins me now. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
And we want to hear from you on this. You're welcome to call in. What do you want to know about your relationship with your dogs and how you live with them? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALKS. So you do research with dogs. Was that because you just wanted to spend more time with them? I mean, how did you wind up picking dogs for your research?
I wish I had been that cunning. But I actually didn't anticipate that I would be studying dogs. I began as a cognitive scientist and was looking for a non-human animal to study to try to test some of my ideas about their abilities. I wound up studying animal play behavior and was looking for a subject. Yeah, and most of the subjects, most mammals play, but not always when you want them to. Mm-hmm. So at the time, I had a dog. I lived with a dog, and I was taking her out three times a day to play. And it slowly dawned on me I should be studying dogs. I studied their play for my dissertation, and it's been all dogs since.
So what are some of the key things you've learned from your research over time?
Well, I think that what the whole field of dog cognition has brought to our understanding is how skilled they are at social cognition, which is to say, understanding how to solve problems using social others and understanding essentially the minds of others, which is something very important to humans and human cognition. I myself focus a lot on dogs' olfactory universe, how great they are at smelling and how that might change how they see the world.
And it turns out from your research, they're really good at smelling. Right.
I mean, we all know that dogs are good at smelling, right? I mean, that's the bomb sniffer dogs or the dogs in the airport. But I think it really drives their perception. I mean, they are living in an olfactory world the way we're living in a visual world.
So let's dive into some of the topics in your book, because there's a lot in there. And as a dog owner myself, there's a lot in there that's challenging, I think, for dog owners. You have a chapter that takes a pretty critical look at spaying and neutering dogs. Is this a movement that's gaining traction?
There is good research out there questioning the early spay-neuter policies, especially, that have become required.
Early meaning early in the dog's life?
That's right. Before 6 months of age, for instance. And that often happens at shelters where they have possession of the dogs at a young age, and before they home them, they spay and neuter them. And a lot of shelters have mandatory spay-neuter policies. Even some legislative areas do. And in this chapter, you know, I live with dogs, too, and I've always had spayed or neutered dogs. And I was told and I believed that it's the responsible thing to do. And what I'm doing in this chapter is just looking at the results of that decision for individual dog owners, but also for the dogs themselves. A lot of the research questions whether it's the best thing for them.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you spayed or neutered your dog? Do you have concerns about that practice or concerns about not employing that practice? Alexandra, it is a pretty counterintuitive approach, given the standard culture around animals. What are some of the specific concerns you have, especially about spaying and neutering at an early age?
What I really wanted to open a discussion about with this chapter is whether it should be the one solution that we as a society bring to solving this problem of overpopulation, which is why there are mandatory spay-neuter policies, because in the 70s, there was a huge overpopulation problem, and millions, maybe 15, 20 million dogs a year were euthanized for no homes. The number is much smaller now for lots of reasons, including but definitely not limited to spaying and neutering. But is it right, for one thing, to make new dogs bear the responsibility of our human inability to control our dogs, right, and control population? We're making new puppies all the time. It's not that there's some dearth of puppies. There are new puppies, and yet other dogs are still being killed, euthanized, because we can't find homes for
them.
But
doesn't that then argue, yes, so then practice spaying and neutering wherever possible so that we can continue to see good results in reducing overpopulation and reducing euthanasia of pets?
Well, it might be so, right? I'm not arguing against spaying and neutering, but it has to work in hand with other changes in policy. For instance, now anyone can breed and make new dogs at any time. We can buy a new dog by the end of this segment. We could have gone online and bought 10 new puppies. If we can do that, there's no way that any amount of spaying and neutering dogs in shelters is going to solve the overpopulation problem. Second, we have to ask, you know, is it good for the dogs themselves? And there is a lot of research, especially recently by Benjamin Hart and his team at UC Davis, which looks very carefully at the results of spaying and neutering for different breeds of dogs over time. And he's seen with some breeds higher rates of cancers, much higher rates of joint disease. When you spay or neuter a dog, you're changing a lot systemically. And so we have to ask, for individual dogs, does it make sense to spay or neuter them?
All right, let's take a call. We've got Dennis from Dorchester on the line. Dennis, go ahead.
Hi, yes. You know, I just had my 10-month-old puppy neutered. And it was a Vizsla, and I had a Vizsla before that I had neutered before 6 months. And I noticed with the older dog, having just neutered the older dog, it seemed to me in the couple of weeks before he got neutered, he was more aggressive with other dogs. And I wonder if that's actually sort of old wives' tale, or if that really could be that they are more aggressive if they remain intact.
Great question for Alexandra. Let me let you answer it.
Right. Thanks for your question. It isn't really, I mean, aggression is defined in very different ways to different people. What you might be seeing is with a 10-month-old male dog is kind of teenageness, right? I mean, they're entering adolescence. So you start to see a lot of behaviors, including more interest in, for instance, like mating behavior than you would have seen as with a young puppy. Is testosterone part of, you know, an adolescent's temperament? Yes, it is, right? And so when you reduce testosterone by taking out the gonads, the reproductive organs, you might see less of the behavior which we're likely to call aggressive. But when dogs are neutered for unwanted aggressive behavior, research has shown that you actually only see reduction in aggression behavior in one of four dogs.
Even afterward.
Afterward.
All right.
That's right.
Okay.
So it's not reliable.
So I want to make sure we get to a couple of the subjects in your book. So I'm going to shift gears now because, again, I have two shelter dogs. And to my chagrin as a dog owner, you take a pretty hard look at the concept of ownership and don't entirely favor it. I have to admit, Sunny and Ernie were on my lap while I was reading that chapter. And I'm like, hey, why in your mind should we think critically about this concept of owning dogs?
Yeah. And it's not that I think that that dogs should be free running around and we shouldn't have relationships with them. You know, it's because we have relationships with them that I question whether they should be owned property. I think it comes as a surprise to most people to realize that even though we consider our animals, our dogs, family members, members of our family, participants in our family who are invaluable, to the law, they are personal property. Our relationship with them is one of owner, and they're valuable. Their value is the price you paid for them. So if you have shelter dogs, that's the price you paid to get them out of the shelter. So if something were to happen to them, somebody's intentional or unintentional violence towards your dogs, the punishment would be essentially giving you the value of those dogs that you paid for them.
And what do you think should change? What's a key piece of public policy or even social practice that should change in the way we think about dog ownership?
I think the law should come more evenly with our attitudes about dogs, which is that they are sentient creatures whose well-being matters, you know, who have things that can go better or worse for them, whose relationship with our family isn't like our relationship with our furniture, but is more like a relationship with other people. So there are lots of legal scholars who have different ideas about how you could change legal policy to bring those more in line.
You know, I wasn't going to say this, but something you said really struck me. So a couple years ago, our last shelter dog, who was quite old, passed away. It felt much more like grandpa had been living with us and left than that, you know, a guinea pig had been living with us and left. So there is something about the way we relate to our pets that seems quite striking.
Yeah, it is. I think they're in on all of the activities of our lives, right? That's something that sentient animals are, not objects, but are the language of ownership and the laws about ownership treat them like inanimate objects.
Let's pick up another call. Susan from Berlin is on the line. Susan, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm wondering about dogs and communication with us. I wonder how much they understand in terms of language. And also, do you think that maybe they have telepathic things? Sometimes my dog looks at me like I'm trying to tell you something, but you're not getting it. And I really wonder.
Well, that's awesome that you asked that, Susan, because, Alexandra, you actually have a chapter on talking to dogs in the book. So why don't you pick up on that?
So it is interesting because thanks for your question. We do talk a lot to dogs, but sometimes we don't really listen to them, right? I mean, we talk to them in ways that are very conversational. Do they understand that? Well, my guess is they are not understanding most of what we say in their direction. However, if you talk to them very carefully and assiduously day after day, they learn words, they can learn combinations of words, and we all know they learn sort of prosody, the sound of a sentence. Do you want to go for a walk? You know, that they learn that and they learn what happens after that. So even though they are not native language users, they can pick up on what we're saying in some level. And you might have heard of some famous language understanding dogs, Rico and Chaser, both border collies. Chaser actually just recently died. Chaser had learned 1,022 names for toys that John Pilley had taught her. And she could do different things vis-a-vis them, nose them or retrieve them. You know, I will say that John spent a couple of years speaking carefully about these toys to Chaser for up to 8 hours a day. So can they learn 1,022 words? Well, this border collie did. There's evidence of that. But we're mostly not talking to dogs like that. We're mostly just using sentences. We're talking to them about what our plans are or observing something about the environment. And they probably don't understand that.
All right. Now, I want to give our listeners a chance to hear just a little bit from the book. I want to have you read a bit from the chapter of your book, which I thought was great fun, in which you describe the scientific process you practice at home with your own dogs.
Okay, yeah, and I will set it up by saying that, you know, the scientific process is all about creating hypotheses and then revising your hypotheses with evidence and coming up with a conclusion. So since I live with dogs myself, you know, I'm always thinking up sometimes harebrained, sometimes reasonable hypotheses. So this is about one of those. Hypothesis: dog is man's best friend. So it has been said, and it seems so to this woman sitting astride two perfect dogs, one of whom once found my lost date book for me, the other of whom smiles at seeing me, both of whom have no cruelty, show reliable cheer, tolerate my peculiarities and shortcomings without judgment, and are silently eloquent. One can't help but wonder, though, as I move off the sofa to make more room for the dogs, if they are at all cunning. I do now purchase bagels specifically for the dogs, pay more for their medical care than my own, and possess pockets full of dehydrated salmon. Our family rarely travels far because we can't bring the dogs with us. We quickly scoop their seemingly precious poop and live in a constant haze of airborne dog fur. Revised hypothesis: dog is a manipulative frenemy. Since adopting a cat, I have seen that there is much overlap in cat and dog behavior, only the cat doesn't wag massively when we're home, gaze at us adoringly, and promptly respond when spoken to. Without the surfeit of crazy friendliness, it's easier to see the cat's behavior for what it is, a means to an end. Sure, she cozies up to every guest to the house, jumping on their lap and relentlessly purring and rubbing against them. But after witnessing this scene a dozen times, it began to look less like affection and more like a way to control access to the warm, soft seating locations available in the house. Now that I think about it, I notice my dog Finnegan making a noise suspiciously like purring when I rubbed his ears. Second revision: dog is a cat. Impossible. Dogs would never betray us like that. Conclusion: cats are really dogs who don't make it past the best friend qualifying rounds.
Excellent.
Thanks.
All right. We only have about 30 seconds left. What's next for you and your work?
I really want to continue to pursue some of these ideas about how we live with dogs and kind of come up with procedures for how we can live with them in the future societally and individually. We all want to do well, do the best for our dogs. You know, what can science bring to that question?
Alexander Horowitz, dog cognition scientist and author of Our Dogs, Ourselves. She's the head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'll be in conversation with Alexandra and other authors tomorrow at the Boston Book Festival in Copley Square, for which WBUR is a representing partner. You can find more information about that on our website at radioboston.org. Listeners, I also want to take a moment to let you know that next Tuesday, October 22nd, Radio Boston will be hosting a special live 90-minute debate with all 8 of the Boston City Council at-large candidates. It will be at WBUR City Space, and we'll be doing it in partnership with the Boston Globe and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. You can actually get free tickets. The debate will air live right here on 90.9 WBUR at 2:30 next Tuesday, but you could come. To do so, go to wbur.org/events.